A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 and an interview between a pair of 2005 Ashes legends. Over the course of the next hour, part of the famous bowling attack reunites as Steve Harmison sits down with his old teammate Simon Jones to discuss the highs and the lows of a short-lived career in the game. For more content like this, as well as match highlights and in-depth analysis, you can subscribe to the following on podcasts available on Apple Podcasts, Acast and Spotify. But for now, you're listening to Steve Harmison in conversation with the former England bowler, Simon Jones.
First of all, thanks for coming on.
No worries.
The game of cricket was probably in your family when you were born. Your old man played England and Glamorgan.
Yeah.
Talk about your upbringing in the game of cricket, standing on the side of the field, potentially being at Sophia Gardens and the club scene and where you learned the game of cricket.
I was lucky, obviously, to have my dad in my life growing up. I probably did the same as other kids. When they were growing up, I played in the back garden with my brothers. That's where I started playing. Got the bug, to be fair. But I loved football before cricket. Played football, just wanted to play football continuously. And then I got to a certain age. I was lucky in growing up in Wales where I had a head teacher in primary school and an English teacher in secondary school where they just adored the game. Mm. You know, everyone else was playing rugby, football, etc. So I had support from them to obviously try and flourish as a cricketer. So I did that. And then I played a game for Wales down in Millfield School. I was under 15. We played against their first team. And I took 6 wickets for absolutely nothing. Mm. Ball came out nicely. And they offered me a scholarship. So I went down there. Matty Maynard came down and signed me up when I was 16. And I turned pro at that age. But if I'm brutally honest with you, do you know when, like, you've been there, done it, you got the T-shirt. My dad had done the same. When a parent doesn't put pressure on you before, and they're there to kind of support you, because as sportsmen and women, they know you're going to have your good days and your bad days. And my dad was always there. He said, look, boy, you're going to have more bad days than good days. Just enjoy the good ones. And I was very lucky to have that kind of support where he was just like, just go out there and enjoy it. So have him in my early career and throughout the rest of my career, to be fair, was a blessing.
And yeah, I totally agree. I'm similar. I mean, my old man didn't have any sort of cricketing connections. I remember one day at Durham, played a day's play. Phoned my old man up the next morning and just asked, because I live an hour away from the ground, and I just for a chat, really. You know, what's happening? And he just said, oh, you were lucky yesterday. I thought you bowled well. I says, oh, you read the paper this morning. He went, no, I was there. You were there. And he was like, yeah, I was there. I said, where were you? And he said, well, you know when you came and fielded like deep backward square? He says, I was just in the stand above that. Not fancy saying hello or backside or whatever, you know, just you're dead, you know, you're all out speaking. That was that was my upbringing. That was my old man. He was the taxi driver, had words to say if I needed it. Yeah. But somebody that it's your own career. And I sometimes think you learn more when that happens. And you mentioned Millfield School there. You went from comprehensive school cricket or secondary school into a like the private school scholarship. Yeah. How do you find that growing up where your arguably education changed as well?
Yeah, it was tough, Harm. Look, I grew up in a very loving environment, and I've got a twin brother. So we were just thick as thieves. We were always together. And for me then to go away to a school in England, I went to a sixth form house, luckily, so we were all the same age, more or less. We had upper six and lower six. So we didn't have any of the real little ones to deal with. But that first 6 months was tough, really tough. Got homesick, wasn't used to the environment. Do you know when you feel like a bit of a poor relation?
Yeah.
In terms of the money and the wealth at the school, it was incredible. Incredible, you know, there was people who were in superpowers around the world. Their children were going there. Yeah. You know, Mick Jagger's kids were there as well. So I was very, very much out of my comfort zone. It didn't feel as if I fitted in. But then once I got into the sporting field, I was okay.
Did you feel that helped having the sport? That was you were there for the sport?
Massively, massively. And to be fair, look, there was a lot of wealthy people there. And I made some great friends, and I'm still friends with them now. So it was a great experience in the sense that it helped me grow up. It helped me stand on my own two feet in a sense, and toughen me up, really. I was the only Welsh lad in the house, so I got some serious stick.
Let's say you got some stick for that.
Yeah, as you can imagine, not as bad as Hoggy stick in the dressing rooms, but
yeah,
it was decent. And you know what? It's all character building. It's all part of your rite of passage, really, is going into it as a grown up. You know, I left there at 18 and I went straight into the professional game. So it was good in a sense that prepared me for, you know, having a bit of banter in a male environment when you went to being a pro, really.
And you went into that Glamorgan dressing room, and it was a winning dressing room. It was a strong dressing room. You know, the likes of Maynard, and I think Hugh Morris was still knocking about then. And, you know, characters like Darren Thomas and Dean Koska, who I got to know and played with. Yeah. I mean, I played with quite a bit in my upbringing. But when you go into that Glamorgan dressing room, it was a bit like playing for Wales. We always felt playing against Glamorgan. You're not playing against the county side, you're playing against a national team. Did it feel that playing for Wales, like you were representing your country rather than your county?
Oh, enormously. And do you know what? As a kid growing up, once I got, you know, became better at cricket than I was football, all I wanted to do was play for Glamorgan. Yes, England was an aspiration, but all I wanted to do was go into that dressing room and put a daff on my chest. And do you know what? When I first walked into that senior dressing room, I was, 16, 17. And you look around the dressing room and you've got Matty Maynard, Hugh Morris, Adrian Dale, Steve James, and Wacky Eunice. Do you know what I mean? You walk in and you're like, oh my good God, I've seen these guys on TV. And now I'm actually sharing a dressing room with them. I don't know whether you felt the same at Durham, because you had some, you know, serious players there as well. But it was a little bit, I was a bit overawed at times, didn't really say much. You know me, I'm quite shy. But I was brought up to respect my elders. So I was very quiet that time. I spoke when I was spoken to. And you know, the older lads would rib me saying I would speak and stuff. Yeah. They would call me the mute. But, you know, that's part of the banter again. And, you know, to share the change rooms with these boys, you're almost realising a dream. Yes, I wasn't there. I was only 16, 17, but it was the start of something I wanted to do.
In the one thing a professional sportsman or sportswoman always has to deal with and battle with is injuries. And you had injuries, you know, that plagued your career and your timeline and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And growing up, trying to become a fast bowler, you had a body of an athlete. You had you looked at me and Hoggy, and you just looked at me and Og and think, them two have just had burger and chips. You look at Simon, and Simon's had a salad. That's why you got the modeling contracts, and me and Hoggy got the watch and ring contracts. And to be fair, did you think that was a hinder to you when, you know, because you were so, your body was so well looked after when you were a young kid?
Yeah, I think I look back and there's, you know, do I look back and think, could I have changed the way I prepared for the games? I think I could have spent a little bit less time in the gym and done a lot more bowling. You know, I used to look at someone like Steve Watkin. He had 1,000-odd first-class wickets and never really saw him in the gym. He used to run and he used to bowl and that was it. And my dad used to go spare because he was old school. He played in the 60s, and that's all they would do. He'd say, I turn up to pre-season, stone overweight, stone and a half overweight, and I'd bowl myself fit. Dominic Cork was very similar when I was at Hampshire. He refused to go in the gym. Ian Brunschweiler, who was the S&C at Hampshire, used to hate it because Corky was like, no, I've played the game. I'm 42 years old. I know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And he would just bowl. He obviously bowl like absolute meds. He bowled probably 65 miles an hour in his first net. But then obviously the speed increased as the months went on. So yeah, if I look back, I would have liked to have maybe bowled a little bit more.
Plenty more to come from Simon Jones, including what it was like to make his England debut and how a major knee injury started to affect his career. You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 as part of the Following On podcast. You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 as part of the Following On podcast, and Steve Harmison in conversation with his former England teammate Simon Jones. Over the next part of the programme, they discuss Jones' breakthrough to the England team and a horrific knee injury that he picked up in Australia in 2002.
As a kid going into that Glamorgan dressing room, you had highs and lows, up and downs. You get to a point where there's talk of England come calling. We go on the Academy 2000, I think it is, when we go to Australia. Is that the first time you think, hold on here, I potentially could play cricket for England here? Because you didn't play a great deal of representative cricket from age group cricket when it comes to that. Neither did I. I got picked on an under-19 tour and I spent a fortnight there and went home because I just didn't like being away from home. And that, like, you had the injuries that ravaged you. I had that side of it that ravaged me, being away from home. Really, you know, was my trouble. But going to Adelaide, and to be honest, I'm not sure if it was a good thing from the ECB's point of view or a bad thing to the ECB's point of view, putting all that money in our pocket, sending 16 guys who are educated in the world, shall we say, and playing them against a bunch of kids, knowing that we're going to win every time, was, yes, it was going to make them look good, but we forged a good bond and a good friendship, which was going to get us to where we wanted to be 4 or 5 years down the line. That Academy trip was a great trip for us all, but it was also a good trip for you because we met a bowling coach who understood us.
Yeah, totally. And do you know what? I look back at, it was 2001. That squad we had, Harm, was unbelievable.
Yeah.
But do you know what? That was probably the hardest 6 months I've ever worked. In terms of on and off the field. But we had fun as well. That was the big thing.
Sunday afternoons at Glenelg and then getting up for Crouchy's sessions at half six in the morning. Crouchy, if anybody that didn't know Robin Crouch, Broadmarsh's best mate, who sadly passed away a few years ago, which I didn't realise.
Oh, no, did he?
He was a professional boxer who was best mates with Rod Marsh, who looked after the England National Academy. And we did a VersiClimber session, which was basically a mountain climbing session, 40 seconds on, with a bicycle boxing session, 40 seconds off. And you did that at 6:30 in the morning, on a Monday morning, after you'd been to Glenelg. Glenelg Hotel, right on the beach from 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and had a good time. So it was literally first floor window. It was like a revolving door for people being sick out the window, wasn't it? People going to work in Adelaide getting spewed on by England cricketers. And it was just a great time. It was a great time. Crouchy as well, good thing about the professional boxer who basically had his first professional fight.
I know,
and he gave up sex for a whole year, didn't he?
Yeah,
now sex for a whole year to prepare for this fight. He got knocked out in the first round, so he was a great man, and he got us fit, didn't he? He got us fit, old school.
Yeah, and I tell you what, he had to be hard, right? Because of that haircut he had. He was like a straight fringe, wasn't it?
Nobody was going to tell him though, was it? He had been cut. His hair was cut with a. It was just that mullet, his fringe had literally been cut with a spirit level. It was literally spirit level on, cut the front off and the mullet in the back.
Yeah, and we had a Tuesday night club as well, didn't we?
The Tuesday Night Club was an interesting club, yeah. That was an interesting one. The Crazy Horse, Rod Marsh didn't even know the Crazy Horse was there, so we took him. And then we denied we'd ever been in there. And then to the girl on reception knew us by our nicknames and not by our first names. So it was just a fantastic trip. It was a great trip.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And like the friendships you made as well. And you know, obviously we had Nicky Peng on the tour. And you know, just an absolute legend of a human being. There's obviously yourself, Fred. That squad we had was unbelievable. But it was what the good thing was, myself, you and Fred, Ian Bell as well, Strousey,
yeah,
Swanee, all went on to play for England, didn't we?
Yeah. No, it was brilliant, and it was a good grounding, because here we all were. We'd all played a very good level of first class cricket. It was probably an ear side that was going out, where Rod Marsh had normally looked after kids. It was an under-19 team he had been producing for Australia. And then we landed. It was brilliant. We landed in the breakfast room on the first morning. Rod Marsh introduces himself, because he had never been anywhere, never seen anybody. He hadn't been to England. And then we weren't allowed butter on our toast. We weren't allowed butter anywhere, weren't we? And then Swanee went and bought a big pack from the from the local shop and put his name on it. So, yeah, we had a great squad, but we had a squad of characters as well.
I remember, obviously, Keezy, he's another legend and one of the funniest human beings I've ever met. And I remember Richard Smith, who was a fitness guy, used to say, right, you've got a day off each week. And it was from midday on Saturday till midday on Sunday, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
And we were all like, we're not having that. We're just going to go out and get blind drunk on Saturday night. You can take us how we come on a Sunday. And I just remember Keezy rebelling. He hated it, didn't he?
Yeah.
He just did have no time for it whatsoever.
Fell asleep on the beach, didn't he?
Yeah.
Got out of a cab, thought it was one way, fell over the wall and just literally fell asleep on the beach. Because he was my roommate. I woke up the next morning, I was like, where's Keezy? So got downstairs, walked down the front of the on reception in the Big Brother house. And we can't find Keezy anywhere. And all of a sudden, we just see this light, just this body on the beach. Keezy had been there for about 8 hours with his hair during that crap.
Do you remember, though, when we did that verse climb session, Keezy was still in his shirt and his jeans, and he had sand plaster on his face.
That was
and he was going up and down.
But it shows you what characters we had and Keezy had, because literally got him off the beach, went straight into the session. He did the session, no questions asked, bang.
Yeah.
Viewed everywhere, by and large, but the characters were there for all to see, and going forward and moving forward from that, you know, to make your debut at Lords. I just spoke to Hoggy, he made his debut at Lords. You made your debut at Lords. That must have been an unbelievable feeling, the history that comes with Lords, but also against, you know, having the backdrop of your dad playing for England as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice to have my dad there, especially from to see him in the crowd. I spotted him, but thing was, I'd never ever played at Lords, and I'd only seen it on TV, so I didn't realize how big that slope was.
Yeah,
and when I got there, I was 22, 23 years old. I think it was 22. And to see it, I was like, wow, here we go. And there was external pressure, because myself and you were deemed the quickest bowlers in the country.
Yeah,
you probably had the edge on me, but it was just one of those things you kind of felt the pressure. Luckily, we batted first, but I remember the night before the test, I was obviously bricking it, and Craig White knocked on my door. He said, "You're right." No, what a human he is. He's just a brilliant guy.
Man.
Are you feeling all right? He said, "Do you want to come for a pint?" So I went down for a pint. Ended up having 9 pints of Stella night before my test debut, and woke up the next morning a little bit dusty. But when you're that age, you're invincible, aren't you?
Yeah, you think
got to the ground, did the warm up, and then Nass won the toss, made the right decision for once, and we batted first. And then I just had a little kip. But then I sat in the balcony and just tried to soak it in. The noise that I'd never played in front of a crowd that big.
Yeah.
And just to soak in the atmosphere, look around the ground. And then, you know, to play against India, you got Tendulkar, Laxman, Dravid, all these legends of the game. It was a little bit of a baptism of fire, because I was still young and very raw. But I got through it all right. Did my side at the end of the game. And then obviously you came in the next test, didn't you, at the Trent Bridge?
I did, yeah, and that was a recurring thing, to be fair.
Yeah.
I come in for the next test, play the next test. We both make it on a plane to Australia.
Yeah.
Go over to Australia. We've got this now in with the big boys. We take a British Lions team to Australia because we take about 10 players who aren't fit and never look like getting fit. And we try and outwit their characters because we think they are. And then the young lads came to the fore because then there was nobody else. We had to play. NASA wins a toss, decides to bowl first on the flattest wicket in the world. And everybody ribs him about it and takes a mick of the decision he made and the bad decision that he made. Yeah. But arguably, you're the one that really has a gripe with it, because if he doesn't win the toss and bowl first and bats first, which he should have done, you might not have had the problems you had with the knee.
And he knocks a four. Wow, it's not happening for England.
Oh, careful.
And he's in trouble.
Oh,
it's Jones too.
I was about 15, 16 rows up in the viewing gallery. You go chasing that ball, you dive, we see your knee go.
Siffy Spriggs got caught. Oh, dear.
I've jumped up and I've ran down. Kirk Russell, physio, ran down. Because I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, one of my best mates is in trouble here. That is a bad way. And the way it happened, it was from my point of view, that was what I seen. You know, what your thoughts were, I couldn't imagine. What were you thinking? What was happening?
Do you know what? And I think what hadn't put me in good stead was us playing at the Allan Border Oval.
Yeah.
If you remember that outfield, it was beautiful, wasn't it? And he slid in it and he just kept on going. So. Yeah. Me being a bit young and green, I just expected every ground in Australia to be exactly the same. Remember, we did a light fielding session the day before, didn't we? Really light.
Didn't
do any sliding, just took a couple of balls, get used to the seats and then got off. So I just chased that ball thinking, right, get after it. You know, your beans are going because you're playing in an Ashes test, and I slid. And I've never forget the pain I felt at home. It was unreal. It just felt as if someone had stuck a knife in my knee. It was that sharp and nasty. And then all I remember is holding my knee. And I remember Kirk coming on, and I remember their surgeon. I'm not a surgeon, but he was a specialist. And then I remember seeing you and Jason Gillespie. And I was thinking, right, I'm in a bit of bother here. And I wouldn't let anyone touch my knee. I was thinking, right, just get away. And then you carried me off. And remember that guy in the crowd?
Threw a Coke can at you, didn't you?
Call me a weak, call me whatever. Yeah.
And then he dropped you because I was going to go in and drop him. It was just.
I would have enjoyed that. I just remember
on the front of the stretcher carrying you. And people have asked me, well, what was going through your head there? And I was like, because they said, oh, you played in the next test match. And I was like, the only thing I could think of was how bad you were. I had no interest in what was going to happen in the future, you know, or what was going to happen for the rest of the test match. I remember going into the dressing room. You came off the stretcher onto the bench. We all came out, and I remember standing by the door for a long, long time because the physios were in and everybody else was in, and I wanted to come in, but I didn't want to come in because the business end was getting done. And then when everybody came out, I walked in and you were lying, you had a towel over your head. And I remember, so I just put my hand on your chest and that feeling there was heartbreaking for me. Can't imagine what it was like for you, but it was heartbreaking for me because of what the academy and what we had all gone through and everything that we had gone with it. And to see where you were was difficult. But I think the strength of character to come back from that and to even play cricket again, never mind play international cricket again, that took some doing, mind.
Yeah, look, it was a dark time after that. I went home for my surgery in Sheffield with a guy called Derek Bickerstaff. Brilliant bloke. I've been lucky with the surgeons I've had. They've all been good guys. Didn't have any airs or graces. It was just straight to the point and got it done. And then it was the longest, probably about 15, 16 months of my life. I was working 5-6 hours a day, 6 days a week with the Glamorgan physio, and just did it. And I was so set in my goals of, right, I've got to get back. I want to see what I can do. It was a long old road, but, you know, then I played in that second team game at Pantage, and we were supposed to keep it on the down low. Someone leaked it to the press. There was like 60 press on the bank waiting to watch me bowl. And I was just like, why do I need this? We're playing against Lancashire. I bowled Chris Goldfield a beamer by accident. He started crying.
not bad thing, to be fair. He was on that then, academy trip as well, but he just played cards all day by himself.
Yeah, Sport Billy. And then managed to get through the game and then got picked on the academy with Rod, went to India, got through that. And then unbelievable. I got called up to play with you boys in West Indies. It was so good to get back, honest to God.
Still to come on the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2, Simon Jones and Steve Harmison look back at the iconic Ashes series in 2005 and those five test matches that changed English cricket forever.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 and an exclusive interview with the former England bowler, Simon Jones. If you missed any of the show or wish to catch up, you can download the podcast from the following on feed, available on Apple Podcasts, Acast and Spotify. But without further ado, he joins Steve Harmison to look back at the iconic Ashes series in 2005. This is the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
I've talked to Huggy about the West Indies. We talked about times in when it was time, mentioned about making our debuts with Gough and Caddick and having such a, I think because of, I can't put my finger on it, but because I've made our debuts with Gough and Caddick, it was like, see the little bit of needle and the bit of bicker. I was like, I can't be like that. I wouldn't want to play if I was like that with you or with Fred or anything. And I thought we all had a bit of that in us to like, well, let's not be like them. We'd be more successful if we, and we all had our times. We all had times, you know, Jamaica came, then you had a goer, you know, a game in Trinidad. Hoggy got his hat trick in Barbados. Fred got first five in his career in Barbados. And then we came and we blew West Indies and New Zealand away. And all of a sudden, you know, the knee injury's gone. You're back. This four-man attack is just ridiculous. We didn't lose a test match when we all four of us played together. We didn't play together that often, but we didn't lose a test match. And then we go to what is arguably the, and Huggy had a great time in South Africa. And then we now go to us to back to Lords. We've got Australia in 2005. And a lot of people's abiding memories of that first test match was the aggression. Let's get at them. Yeah, get in their faces and we'll take Australia on toe to toe. And the people will say, well, where did that come from? And a lot of it came down to the one day game when you decided to throw the ball at the biggest bloke on the Australian team and pick a fight with him. And you took Collie as you took Collie as your big man. It didn't help.
Yeah, I'm a posher team of being
you threw the ball at Matthew Hayden.
Well, that wasn't intentional from Jones. He apologises, but Hayden's not impressed with that.
Do you know what? It was one of those things where us as a unit, we were so collective. We all had each other's backs. We wanted to show that we weren't intimidated by these boys because they just bullied everyone, didn't they? They just got on the field. Now, what a side that was they had. It was unbelievable. For them, they just went out and like imposed themselves on people. I thought, right, I'm not having it. So I thought, Ryan, we'll throw the ball, as we all do. And it came out wrong. No, he was like Buzz Lightyear, wasn't he?
He's a big lad.
He's got the biggest chest I've ever seen in my life. And it's hit him, and he's turned around, and I thought, oh, here we go. And he said, what the did you do that for? So I'm walking down then to do an apology. And then Collie's come in and said something. I don't think he understood Collie because he just stared at him. And then Straussy came in with the posh I've ever heard in my life. And then you and Fred started coming in, and that's when Hayden thought, well, nah, I'm all right. I just turned back around and he walked back down the wicket. But it was one of those things where it got the crowd going, didn't it?
Yeah, it got the crowd going, but I think it got people talking about we're not going to sit down, we're not going to back down. And then we get to Lords. So we get to Lords.
Well, that's hit him on the helmet.
Another helmet has been hit. All three Australian batsmen have now been hit.
Langer gets hit, Ponting gets hit, Hayden gets hit. Hoggy gets Hayden.
That's bold. That's a good delivery.
I get Ponting.
Edged. Gone. Third slip. Takes the catch. The Australian captain is out.
Fred gets Langer. You get Martin.
Gone. First ball. What a start for Simon Jones. What a comeback into Ashes Test match cricket.
It couldn't happen any better. Our four fast bowlers, from Vaughan's point of view, our four fast bowlers have all got a wicket. We've got Australia under the pump. First morning of the first Test match. Doesn't get any better than this.
Yeah. Oh, look. And we just wanted to get out there, didn't we? One of my biggest memories of Lords that Test match was walking through that long room.
Yeah.
And normally you can there's the odd good luck, blah, blah, blah.
What they picked him for again.
It erupted, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the hair's standing on the back of our neck. We're all looking at each other going, what the hell is going on here? Yeah. And then Vaughan did his speech. But the best thing for me was I knew we were ready as a group of bowlers. I knew we were just in the peak form. We could have bowled to anyone. Yeah. And I knew we were in a good place. It wasn't a bad thing that we bowled first. Just wanted to get into them. I'd have hated waiting in our dressing room to get on the field to bowl. I'd have hated it. Mm. And it was just great that we got out there. And look, you bowled speed of light first. That, you know, I watched some of the Aussies speaking about that first period on videos and that. And they were all like, they've never seen Hayden get hit. They've never seen Ponting get hit in the head. And, you know, you got straight after him.
But I also think on that, my opinion on that is I thought we've got them. Not because they got hit. I thought they were nervous. They were nervous. They don't get hit if they're not nervous. They don't get static if they're not nervous. And I thought that was when we missed the trick. Leaving Lords, I thought we've missed this trick here. We should have won this. This was the Test match to win. Yeah. And all of a sudden now we start doubting. And then we go to Edgbaston and it was like, we're not going to get over the line here. Yeah, you know, we're not going to get over the line. I know you dropped that catch with 15 to go, but at what point did you feel we're not winning this? We're not going to get 107 to win. Yeah. We've got to get two wickets, and I think we need 15 when you drop the catch.
Yeah.
But 107. At what point did you think we're not winning this?
I started worrying right when Shane Warne and Brett Lee put that partnership together.
Yeah.
Because they're both dangerous as hell. Warne was so difficult to bowl to. He just hit it funny places, didn't he? So destructive. And Brett Lee could hit a clean ball. And it was just like, when they got to about 40, I started panicking.
Yeah.
I was thinking, here we go. This is going to be a bit of an arse nipper. But you and Fred were unbelievable that morning. Just bowled and bowled and bowled. That ball he bowled to Clark the night before as well.
Oh, Stephen Harmison with a slower ball. One of the great balls. Given the moment, given the batsman, and given the match, that is a staggering gamble that's played off for Harmison.
But all I remember, right, it was you bowled that ball and Brett Lee smashed it to point, didn't he? And that was me.
He pointed to you, yeah. He was right out to you, yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking, don't miss this.
I was going to say, at what point when you got it in your hands, did you think, thank God I've stopped it?
Yeah, imagine I'd have gone through my legs. I'd never play for England again. As I've left it go then, throw it in the gear, right?
There was nobody backing up.
Yeah, don't go over his head.
There was nobody backing up. We had a 7-2 field. There was nobody backing up. It was crazy.
Just it was automatic response, you know? But yeah, then obviously it got down and down and down and down after I dropped that catch. And that was the worst I've ever felt on a cricket field.
How was it then when you go to Old Trafford? If there was ever a Test matches lined up for the bowlers, this was Simon Jones and Andrew Flintoff's, because this was where the ball was going to reverse swing. And yeah. you just didn't disappoint. Come to second innings, you got 6-4. And I still say to this day, if you didn't get cramp at the end of that day, we would have won. Because Vaughan has to bring me back, and my legs have gone. Fred's going well. Hoggy's legs have gone. I've gone. And it's a case of... But during that spell, the noise of the wicket when Michael Clarke left that ball, it was deafening. Even now, I can still hear it.
That is very good.
The clunk of the stump when he left it was priceless. And that was Simon Jones, the emotion of Brisbane going to once. This was the other side of the emotion of Brisbane.
Yeah. I always, when I was training and when I was preparing, I'd always think back to Brisbane because I was thinking, right, as a cricketer and as a sports person, I just wanted to test myself against the best in the game, the elite.
Yeah.
And those Aussies were the elite. I wanted to actually see how good I could be. I wanted to see if I could live with these boys. And so when I bowled Clarke like that, because I'd set him up with the away swing and then brought it back and see him just done. And he's just stood there because he paused for a bit, didn't he? And there was a little bit of a relationship there where, you know, he used to get on our nerves a bit because he was just wrong, shame on, like popped to a blanket, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And you're just watching him all the time. A hell of a player. But to get him like that, I've seen that video played back, and there's an old couple in the crowd, right? And you can see them hugging. And I'm thinking, what we've done as a team, and like when you bowled at Lords or whatever, all the way through the series, we've given people memories, you know what I mean? Yeah. And that was the biggest thing for me.
Yeah.
Just to see that old couple, I don't know if they talk about it, I don't know if they're still alive, but
yeah.
Just to see people's reactions was amazing.
Well, that was the day where 10,000 people got locked out of a test match in England. So that tells
you. Did you drive down a hard shoulder?
I had to drive down for a mile because I was late again. Me and Gareth were late again. Fletcher's giving me wrong again for being late, and I'm driving for about a mile down on a hard shoulder trying to get in. I thought it was honestly, I'm driving in the ground and we're thinking there's a bomb scare. There's 10,000. Mm. There's nobody going in the ground, and when we got in, we realized, wow.
When have you ever warmed up in front of a full house? I don't think any cricketers have.
I was playing football at Old Trafford in front of 25,000 people. Unfortunately, I was on the cricket ground, and this wasn't a theory of dream. But, and we go to. I love telling this story. We go to Trent Bridge.
Oh, here we go.
And we've bowled, come through. You've got again. Simon Jones is to the fore again. Reverse swing comes. We knock and you knock Australia over. And I remember Vaughan getting us in a huddle and going, right, what are we going to do? And bowlers, what do you think? We're going to make them follow on. And following on was unheard of. You just didn't make anybody follow on. Everybody.
I don't think they had, did they? The Aussies hadn't done it ever.
Nobody had ever made Australia follow on, but following on was unheard of in the game at the time. And Vaughan's gone, bowlers, should we make them follow on? And it was like, yeah, I'm all right. And I remember you going, yep. And then literally 20 minutes later, Gary Pratt's on the pitch and we're going, who's off? And I was like, oh, Simon, he's injured. And I was like, what? He's told us we're going to carry on. We want to come out. So you were just like you became our cheerleader for the second innings.
But
like I've said many times before, if you didn't get injured there, Gary Pratt wouldn't have run Ricky Ponting out because there's no way you would have run him out from
no, no. It was one of the things. I had an ankle problem that started at the end of the Lord's test, and I'd had like three cortisone injections. I'd had like a couple of bone spurs that were playing up. And I'd had a little bit of local anaesthetic. Do you know when you get like your jaw done?
Yeah.
And that's what my ankle felt like in the end. And I just couldn't run. I couldn't do anything. It was just the worst feeling ever. I thought, right, I'm either going to break my leg here or do something else. But when Pratty came on.
Oh, it's out. And that's out. I think Ponting is gone here. It's the 12th man, Gary Pratt, who's hit the stumps with a direct hit.
We picked it up and threw. And then Ponting was what? But that far short, wasn't he?
Not far short, match. Yeah.
Just to see Ponting walking off, though, because that's the first time I thought these boys are rattled.
They're cracked.
Really rattled.
Yeah.
Because Fletcher stood on the back, he's smiling at him. Because Fletcher didn't smile very often.
Wouldn't smile for anybody.
Yeah. No.
Well, he had a bat in his hand, so he had half a chance of making a connection with Fletcher.
The boy said that Ponting was shouting up the stairs, wasn't he?
You were shouting and swearing, what you're laughing at. And it was like, well, you mustn't have been talking to Fletcher. He was like, what do you mean? I was like, well, I've played for Fletcher for 5 years now, and Fletcher's not smiled yet in 5 years. You're getting a crack and a smile out of him walking up the stairs at Trent Bridge. So, but there was a lot hooing and hawing about Pratt being on the field, but you never played again. You never played international cricket again after that injury. Yeah. And there was a lot of talk about what was going on. But just before I mentioned that, what was going through your mind standing with a medical boot on, watching Hoggard walk out to bat and thinking, right, I'm going to have to take this off and put my pads on now when we need six to win? Because if Brett Lee gets Hoggy out, Army's not going to last 2 minutes against that sort of. And I might have to go out and bat here.
Yeah, I was honestly thinking, right, if Hoggy gets out here and Army's going down those stairs, I'm going to have to follow him. Because there's no way I'm getting out in the pitch on time because I'll get timed out because I was in my boot. So I was thinking, right, I've got to make a plan here. So if I'll follow Army down, I'll sit on the fence just in case Army goes first pill. Yeah. And then I'll have to try and knock my way out. But you know what? I've seen some of that footage back, and the way him, Hoggy and Gyro batted, it was incredible, wasn't it? Because Brett Lee was bowling fast as well.
He was bowling fast, and Sheehan was turned at square.
Yeah, and just to watch those two going to work, and you see little Hoggy, his hair is sticking out the back, isn't it? And when he hit Brett Lee for four through the covers, I've never seen him play cover drive in my life.
I didn't think one of them bats could hit fours in two. I didn't think Hoggy had it in him to hit a four because he just blocked that.
I think he could have used a signature bat and it would have gone for four. The pace he was.
Yes, exactly.
It was unbelievable. But yeah, I was worried slightly, Harm.
Still to come on the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2, Simon Jones discussing what he did in the Downing Street Garden and the celebrations after winning the Ashes in 2005.
From these two gentlemen.
All-time perfect. There it is.
England have regained the Ashes.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 as part of the Following On podcast and our exclusive interview with the former England bowler Simon Jones. They've already discussed the highs and lows of his short-lived career, but in the final part of the programme, reflect on the famous celebrations in Trafalgar Square as England regained the Ashes in 2005.
We go, finish at the Oval, and then we are Ashes winners. All the accolades that come with it, and the bus trip. We get on a bus at 9.30 in the morning, 12 Asbos get on a bus and go around London. And I've just mentioned, I've talked to Hoggy about it, and the minute I went round the corner at Trafalgar Square and seen all them people was the minute I thought, because you've been in such a, talking about COVID bubbles, but you've been in a bubble where you've been detached from it. What's happening with the Ashes? But I realised and hit home what it meant to the people of this country when I went around that corner and seen 250,000 people. It was like a pop concert waiting for us, this red bus to go around the corner.
To be fair though, Harm, remember when we went out, we were thinking like the night before, why the hell are we on a bus trip?
Yeah.
No one's going to be there.
Exactly.
No one's going to come and see us. Now, you see all the football teams that win the league or whatever it is, and there's millions of people there. And we're thinking, we're going to have one man and his dog.
Yeah.
But then we went out, and we're like, Jesus. And then Trafalgar Square was just different class. I remember the guy, I don't know who it was, he was going along, and he was singing, wasn't he?
The long-haired Barmy Army guy.
And he's got going along.
Yeah.
Each of the lads, wasn't he? And then he had the
microphone.
And he pulled it away.
Yeah. But he gave it to Fred, then he knocked it off because he got about 3 seconds through a caught in a trap from Elvis, and he had to knock it off. Fred thought, this is my time to sort of audition to be Stars in Their Eyes tonight, Matthew. I'm going to be Elvis Presley. He was on his way. But ask Hoggy a question about a serious question about what he said to the Prime Minister.
Yeah,
there was something else happening in the Prime Minister's garden. Are you going to own up 30 years, 20 odd years on? Was it you?
It was me, yeah.
It was you. I knew it was you.
Yeah, I thought I'm gonna leave my little mark on the 10 Downing Street. I thought
that. But to be fair, we talked about not getting any bad press. We never got any bad press at all from that. And we were in a decent state. And it was something that I felt, because you talk about Strousey and his posh accent, and you talked about we had a whole row of different characters in there, but we had a lot of working class Northern lads or lads who had been brought up, not who were what you'd usually associate with English cricket, which was the old school Thai, private schools, university educated. You know, we were northern lads or working class educated lads who were acting in a working class educated way, who performed ridiculously well. And I thought the people of this country warmed to us.
I think as well, Harm, as you've just pointed out there, I think people related to us.
Yeah.
And it was good in a way. But I think the other thing that people loved was the fact we all just worked together. We were just a family. And they liked the fact that we all wanted each other to do well. There was no needle or anything going around. There's no jealousy. And they knew we liked the beer. I think that's what they liked. I think they knew that we would just be normal human beings. We got, like, I remember when we went at Edgebast, we were all in walkabout, weren't we?
Yeah, we were.
With the Aussies, I had headbands on, Hoggy had headbands on, Belly did, and we just were the Aussies having a laugh, and they loved it, didn't they?
I think, since we thought we were going to be in the walkabout an hour sooner than we actually were, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah, we planned it.
We got the accolades off the back of that, and, you know, the MBEs and everything that went back. But we went on a different path and a different journey to Simon Jones. You know, some of us went on to India, Pakistan and played, and then had a lot more time playing. But like I alluded to just a second ago, Simon Jones' international career ended there, and the injuries really started. How did that affect you as a person, as a cricketer, as a person? Because you moved down to Hampshire, you tried different things, but whatever you tried didn't really seem to get you back on the field for a long time, or long enough time to really sort of try and force your way back into that England side. How tough was that to get over mentally?
It was immensely tough, Harm. I look back and I was taking one step forward, two steps back all the time. And it was just down to my pure selfishness. I wasn't going to give in. If I look back now, and people will say, do you have any regrets? Yeah, my regret, I should have finished in 2006.
Yeah.
I should have retired. I wouldn't have had the 7 years of hell then.
Yeah. And just got on with your life.
Yeah, I've had 10 or 12 knee ops. Left knee is cooked now. And I could have just gone on to do something else. But I just wanted to prove people wrong, and it backfired, really.
And how is Simon Jones now? You know, what is daily routine, everything that goes with the big Welshman that won the Ashes for England, MBE, Simon Jones, who you say should have retired in 2006 and got on with his life. What is that life until now?
Life is good. I'm working for Kerry London, an independent insurance broker, and I've been there over a year now, and I'm loving it. It's really good. I'm still involved in the game, still involved in sport.
Yeah,
and obviously I'm doing other stuff in construction and stuff with their insurances, but I can take a back seat. I'm not coaching. I'm not stuck in a dressing room. I'm not traveling.
Yeah,
I'm only doing this work, and I'm loving it. My boss Dean Kalaz is an absolute hero. They've looked after me really well. They've introduced me to all the staff, and they're looking after me and preparing me for what I'm going to do. You can't imagine me sending emails. I know that.
Oh, I can't imagine you sending emails. Struggle to get on a telephone and mind an email.
Yeah, I know. But I'm, it's going really well. I'm really loving life. I felt as if I couldn't find my route in life after I finished.
Yeah.
And to be fair, the first 4 years were tough, really tough. I felt lost. But then obviously I met Dean last year through the PCA.
Yeah.
And just, I haven't looked back.
No, brilliant. Matt, I wish you every success with that.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you very, very much for spending time and giving your honest opinion about life in England cricket, and also owning up to the one thing that a lot of people wanted to know. And the answer was, yes, you did do it. The question was, urinate in the Prime Minister's garden. There was a lot of things going on in that Prime Minister's garden at that time. And somebody just snuck in the corner and had a little tinkle in the bushes. I always said, you can narrow it down a bit. He was from Wales, and he was a big fast bowler, and he's a beautiful man. Simon, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me, mate. Look after yourself, all right?
Our thanks to both Steve Harmison and Simon Jones for the last hour. If you missed any of the show or wish to catch up, you can download the podcast on the following on feed, available on Apple Podcasts, Acast and Spotify. Thanks for listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.